Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
When he went down that morning to see them at breakfast, he decided he needed to save the world. He went to his room and returned with a shotgun. His father tried to wrestle the shotgun from him, and it was at that point that the first shot was fired. And from there, you know, it was pandemonium, basically.
In 1997, Stephen Anderson killed six people and injured four others in the little North Island town of Rorimu. It's one of New Zealand's worst mass killings. Anderson had paranoid schizophrenia and was eventually found not guilty by reason of insanity. I'm Jesse Mulligan, and this is Crimes NZ, a podcast where I speak with people connected to our country's most serious crimes. Shortly, we'll be talking with News Hub Investigations reporter Michael Mora, but first, here's Jim Bolger, who was New Zealand's Prime Minister in 1997.
The biggest difficulty, of course, is if a person does have a mental disability or, for whatever reason, enters into the mental state where you're likely to murder six people, then you're probably not going to have any gun laws that are going to prevent every one of those incidents taking place. The person who engages in this sort of a slaughter obviously is not normal at the time they're doing it. They obviously have some psychotic disability at that stage, some mental disability at that stage. No normal person goes out and shoots six people and wounds six people.
That's former Prime Minister Jim Bolger speaking to Morning Report in February 1997. And News Hub Investigations reporter Michael Mora interviewed Stephen for a report on him and the case several years ago. He joins me now. Hi, Michael.
Hey, great to be here, Jesse.
Yeah, nice to have you in studio. How did you get interested in this case?
Well, I think actually what originally sort of prompted me to tell the story, I mean, don't forget this was many years ago before I'd even thought about starting my journalism career. But I guess I felt that we had all heard a lot in the media about the horror of that day. We'd heard from families, we'd heard from survivors, we'd heard from politicians, we'd heard from commentators. What I didn't think we'd heard a lot from is from Stephen Anderson himself. And I really wanted to understand, I guess, what Steve was thinking that day. I wanted to get an insight into his mental state. And I also think I wanted to challenge some of the stigma that surrounded Rorimu and the horrific events that unfolded. This story, in my opinion, has long been characterised as a story of fear and misunderstanding. And I guess I wanted to delve into this story to raise awareness about mental health and to tell a story that was from the person at the centre of it all. Mm. Because when horrific events like this happen, it's easy to characterise someone as a mass killer and that's it. They're just a mass killer. They don't deserve a place in society. They deserve to be locked up. And it was actually one particular headline that I read in a news article that really piqued my interest in the story. And from what I had observed of the coverage of this tragedy, it was always the headlines like mass killer gets leave, mass killer returns to hospital, mass killer gets a job, mass killer is sacked from job. And I guess I sort of felt that while I understand the news value in someone who has committed such horrific crimes, I felt that there needed to be a bit of a balancing of the table, if so to speak, because I felt like some of the headlines that had been produced around this event were, in my opinion, sensationalist.
And there's value in doing that, not just so that we get to know the person or so that they get a fair show in the media, but also often with a mass shooting, you don't get the opportunity to talk to the perpetrator afterwards because they take their own life or they're shot by police. And so I suppose it was a rare opportunity to get inside the head of somebody who'd done something so horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is pretty rare. And Stephen and his mother, Helen, have, for very good reason, been very reluctant to talk to anyone in the media. You know, why would you, considering what's happened, considering how many people died?
Can you tell a bit about what it took to get him to sit down with you?
I was reading through some of the previous reporting on this case, and I simply approached it in the sense that I wanted to tell Stephen's story for once. It wasn't a story where I was going to, you know, be seeking to have reaction from different politicians or, you know, different commentators on whether the decision for him not to be thrown in jail, lock and key, was the right one. It was purely his story, what happened that day, what he was thinking, in an attempt to educate the public about mental health and to help people understand that on that day, Stephen was in a deluded, confused state.
So can you give us a bit of background to that day in 1997? Tell us a bit about Stephen.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is without a doubt, you know, up there with one of the worst, you know, mass shootings we'd seen at the time, right up there with the Bain and the Arimawana killings. And this all happened in February 8th, 1997. And your listeners may know or recognise the name Rauremu, probably because of the events that unfolded there. But it's also a small North Island settlement, Central North Island, and if you've ever gone skiing at Whakapapa, you may well have passed through this on the way to the mountain. It's probably
It's got the spiral train track, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's probably about 30 or 40 minutes from the mountain. And so on this weekend, Stephen's family, Helen and Neville Anderson, had got some friends together, four other couples, for a weekend break at their family lodge in Rauremu. So Stephen's dad had built the lodge there years earlier as a family holiday home, and Stephen had been unwell at the time, so his parents, Helen and Neville, decided that the best thing to do and the safest thing was to bring Stephen with them for the weekend, as they didn't think he was well enough to stay in Wellington. Now, just at this point, it's probably good to point out that 2 years earlier, Stephen had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so schizophrenia is a chronic condition, and symptoms can vary from mild to severe. At the severe end, you can become delusional or even have hallucinations where you see, hear or smell things that are not there in reality. And so it's characterised by episodes of what's called psychosis, and that's where you can have changes in your thoughts and your perceptions and your mood. And Stephen Anderson, when he arrived at the lodge, at the family lodge in Rauremu on that day, was experiencing the beginning of a psychotic episode. And it was breakfast time on the morning of February the 8th when this tragedy unfolded. Stephen had not been taking his medication and had been using cannabis prior to the events that unfolded. And Stephen told me, while he loved his family, at this time he was so paranoid, so confused, he became convinced that his father and his father's friends who were in that room were part of a conspiracy to end the world. And his father, he thought, was the ringleader of this conspiracy. And he loved his father. He grew up with him, going into the bush and leading a fairly normal childhood. But in his words, when he went down that morning to see them at breakfast, he decided he needed to save the world. And he went into the family dining room where he saw everyone, and this was really confirmation of his beliefs at the time, his thoughts. This was confirmation that he needed to take action. And it was at this point that he went to his room and returned with a shotgun. And his father tried to wrestle the shotgun from him. And it was at that point that the first shot was fired. And from there, you know, it was pandemonium, basically. People were scrambling to get away. Stephen's mother managed to escape out a window, but many others didn't. And many of them were shot at point-blank range and died at the scene. In total, 10 people were shot and 6 of them would die on that day.
Why did he have access to a shotgun?
Well, that's one of the issues that has come up in time and time again. His father would often do hunting. Clearly, there was an issue here with the safekeeping of that firearm. Clearly, in Stephen's state, he should have never been able to access nor know where weapons like this were. So that was, you know, just one of many of the issues that were identified in the lead up to this crisis. But it's worth also bearing in mind that at this time, there was no real understanding of exactly how sick Stephen was, exactly what was going through his mind, or what it was that he was about to carry out.
Yeah. 6 were killed, as you say. 4 were wounded. How serious were those injuries?
Oh, you know, really serious. I mean, some of these people are, you know, still sort of getting through the injuries. And I guess it's important to also, you know, acknowledge all the families and victims on that day. And bearing in mind that, you know, talking about this does bring up all these memories and resurface everything, not only for Stephen and his mother and their family, but also for all of the victims. And I just want to, you know, convey my condolences and sympathies to all of those who were killed or injured on that day. So including those who were shot and died were Neville Anderson, Steve's father, Anthony McCarthy, a family friend of the Andersons who had come to stay for the weekend, John Matthews, a family friend, Stephen Hansen, Andrea Brander, and Henk van der Wettering, who was a neighbour of the Andersons in Rauremu. So I just want to acknowledge those families, because bringing something like this up, as it does come up sometimes in the media, is always pretty raw. And I know a lot of these people, those who survived and families who lost loved ones, probably won't go a single day without remembering what occurred way back then.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. And you know, people do really, people are fascinated by crimes, and too often when we're covering them, we forget that there are real victims out there and families of victims. Have you spoken to any of the victims in the course of your investigations in this case?
Yes, I have. I notified all the families when I ran the story ahead of running it, to give them a heads up about that it was coming out. I know for some families, they will never, ever forget or forgive what happened on that day in 1997. Some, but not all, will say that Stephen Anderson should have been given a proper punishment. He should have been locked up and not given the opportunities that those who died have had taken from them. But I know that others appreciated my coverage of the story.
Incredibly, his mother escaped.
Yeah, that's right. And Stephen said to me himself, I mean, that was just pure luck. There's every chance that he would have shot his mother, Helen, on that day. It was just fortunate that she managed to get out a window and get to the neighbours where the police were called. You know, you can imagine the terror. There's people sort of, you know, running around the place and hiding in bush, lying on the floor, pretending to be dead. It was absolute chaos, and eventually the police rolled in helicopters and managed to arrest Stephen, where he was, you know, taken away and later admitted to murder quite quickly.
Did he try and escape or hide or leave the premises?
He was still on the premises. I think there was a period where he was hiding in bush, but I don't think that he actively tried to evade law enforcement for hours and hours, although, in his words, he told me he didn't trust the police at the time. He eventually surrendered and gave up and was taken away.
Okay. What are his mother's feelings about the day and about Stephen?
Look, Helen is really an incredible woman who has provided so much love and support to Stephen over this period. You know, she said to me at the time when this happened and Stephen was arrested and taken to the Forensic and Rehabilitation Hospital in Porirua. Initially, actually, sorry, he was taken to, I think, Waikerea Prison. And at that point, you know, Helen was sort of wanted to visit but was in two minds. I mean, you can imagine if such atrocities had been carried out, how you would feel as a mum. But then she said she turned up at the prison and saw Stephen and just gave him a big hug and, you know, told him that she loved him. And I think that her feelings is that she just wants the best for her son, and she wants and hopes that society will get to a stage where they understand that on that day Stephen was not Steve. He was acting on things that were not real, and that's certainly the sentiment that Stephen articulated throughout the interview, that the point at which he took that gun and began shooting, he was in a state of psychosis where what he perceived to be doing, he thought was the right thing. He thought that that was the right thing and he had to take action to save the world. And that's the sad thing about mental illness and having that understanding. And I guess from Helen's perspective, yeah, as I say, who's been so incredibly supportive over all these years, she hopes that she and her son can get on and try and live a normal-ish life.
Mm. And yet still you will know that it won't sit comfortably with a lot of people listening, the idea that someone could commit 6 murders, 4 attempted murders, and then we say, well, they weren't in control of their actions and they thought reality was different, and so that's that, right? So where do we seek responsibility, culpability, or how do we change things so it doesn't happen again?
Well, I think there's been some huge learnings from what happened in Rauremu, and one of the things that came out was that the coroner found there were multiple shortcomings in Stephen's care before the tragedy. You know, a coroner would later find that after the killings there were gaps in his treatment, which the coroner described as inexcusable, and confusion over who was monitoring Stephen. Patient notes were not being shared, and experts just weren't kind of communicating with each other about what was really going on. In the sense of culpability, I think that the law as it stands is there for a reason, and it's very hard to understand, as you just mentioned, if you think about it. Stephen was acquitted of all 6 charges of murder, so he doesn't actually even have a conviction. So he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And this is a very difficult concept to understand, because basically he's not guilty by reason of insanity because that means the person was so mentally disturbed or incapacitated at the time of the offence that did not have the intent to commit the crime. So that is determined by a judge based on relevant medical evidence. So broadly speaking, it means the defendant is deemed not mentally capable of being legally responsible for their actions. That is, of course, a difficult concept to grasp, but that is the reality of our laws, yeah. And that is the way it has been for some time.
What can you tell us about the trial?
Well, I didn't attend the trial, but I know that it went on for, you know, a very, very long time. And, you know, it's not something that any of the families or survivors will ever forget, because at the end of it, of course, some family members wanted him to go to jail. And so you can imagine as a parent or sibling for the person who's been in the dock to be basically given the tick that, oh, actually, you're not guilty of anything. And that's a very harsh reality to cope with, to know that the punishment as we would think is proper, i.e. locking someone up and throwing away the key, is not dealt out. But in my opinion, there has been a huge penalty here. Stephen has spent decades at a rehabilitation and forensic hospital in Porirua, where he's been gradually allowed over various periods of his life a little more freedom to go and see his mother and to try and get on. But, you know, I guess Stephen knows that what he did back then was wrong. He knows that now taking the medication, the antipsychotics and that sort of thing is an important part of his rehabilitation and helps him, you know, remain steady and on top of things. And he just hopes that people will see him being compliant with that treatment as a way of kind of moving forward. But, I mean, in terms of a punishment, I think Stephen Anderson has been through, you know, a fair amount, not seeking to minimise here what those who have lost loved ones on that day have been through themselves.
How much do you think, or in your analysis, does the cannabis use have to do with what happened that day?
Look, I think there's evidence that cannabis can contribute to psychosis, and it can, you know, increase problems in those who are already having mood disorders. I think that's been well established, and I think, you know, Stephen probably knows that, and at the time, of course, was telling his parents that he was complying with his, you know, medication. In fact, in reality, he was taking it sporadically, and increasingly he was, you know, using cannabis. And I think this kind of begun, you know, in his teenage years. I mean, Stephen had a very normal upbringing. You know, he lived in nice homes in Wellington and in very nice suburbs. You know, he travelled overseas with his parents. He loved both his parents. He'd go out on outdoors hunting trips with his dad, Neville. But I think it was in his early teenage years where, you know, he said to me that he just felt that he wasn't in a good space, and all he knew was that the world didn't seem like a very friendly place and that he didn't like himself. And this is ultimately where things started to unravel. And I think it sort of began with what he thought might have been depression. But certainly I think there's evidence that cannabis is not a useful drug when you have a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
So what is he like 20 years or so after this event? What's he like as a person?
Look, I actually found him to be a pretty kind and caring individual. Of course, he said to me that, you know, Michael, I'm not the monster that I've been painted out to be, and I'd have to agree with that. I found him a very calm and actually quite humorous individual. He's a very talented artist and is busy crafting jewellery and gold and silver. And that is a great thing for him. You know, it's often people describe a thing called mindfulness, and I think Stephen's found an outlet, if you like, where he can focus and create, and that's what his passion is, that's what he loves doing. So I found him to be a gentle, kind and thoughtful individual, when I met him, and I found his mum, Helen, to be endlessly supportive and loving. And, you know, I think without Helen's support of Stephen, things, you know, could be very different for him at this juncture in his life. And he knows that and is, you know, forever grateful for his mum, who has stood by him and helped him recover over many, many years to the point where he is now.
Has he forgiven himself?
It's a hard question, and I put this question to Stephen, and he said he had kind of, you know, let himself off the hook a little bit, but he had not fully forgiven himself, from my impressions, and that's certainly what he said. I think he wakes up every day knowing what he did, feeling remorse, and trying to sort of move on with his life. And so I don't think he has, you know, fully forgiven himself. But I do know that while some family members will say that, you know, Stephen hasn't shown remorse and he should be kind of locked up and done away with, there are actually, I was surprised at the response I got from my story at the time, including from a woman who was John Matthews' brother. John Matthews was one of those, a good friend of the Andersons, who was shot that day and died. And I'll just read you a little bit of her email. This was the day after the story went to air. It was apparent to us throughout this that Stephen was very unwell, that the world for him at the time of the tragedy was not like the world for anyone else. We therefore have always accepted that he was sick and that the verdict at his trial was just and correct. Thank you again for your professionalism in this story. I'm not sure that everyone will be happy with your work, but what you and your team have done is important. It is important that those who suffer from mental health conditions are not stigmatized and that they are able to take their place in society once again. And I guess that last sentence about taking place in society once again is really Steve's overriding wish. He just wants to be Steve. To a degree, Steve will always face a bit of a hostile world. You can't get out of what happened. You can't bury that. You can't smooth that over. But what he can try and do is progress with his life, contribute to society in a meaningful way. The key is if society will allow him to do that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. There's a huge back catalogue of Crimes NZ episodes to binge, from the disappearance of Ben Smart and Olivia Hope to the kidnapping of baby Kahu. They are all available on the RNZ Podcasts page, or on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Don't forget to follow our series, and if you enjoyed it, give it a rating so others can find it too.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.